Blog Talk Radio.
On the Edge, real talk about real issues.
Welcome to the On The Edge show with Katie Barnett and friends. I'm your host, Katie Barnett. Well, we made it to hump day, everybody, so let's thank God for another day of being here to have another midweek grumbling session to be able to gather up in here, because you know that life is not promised to anyone. We have been posting enough about topics to prove that theory. So let's be thankful for each and every day that we can open up our eyes and take another breath. Now, with that being said, let's start out with our shout-outs. I'm going to start off today with saying thank you to the comedians that came out and got gathered last night at the Abella Lounge in Lower Manhattan, New York. Yesterday, they had a fundraiser called Comedy Kids, which you guys have all been hearing me advertise and broadcast about, hosted by, well, actually sponsored, and the event was taking place under Simply Sensational, Inc. with Marcia Morgan and Stephanie Hammond-Tillette. The Comedy Cares fundraiser was to help raise awareness in men for health and to allow comedians to be able to afford health care, because freelance workers, really, they get no love when it comes to that. The show was absolutely off the hook. It was amazing. Every comedian that stepped up there gave us a laugh for fun. And the content that they delivered and the thing that they spoke about. And after their laughs, they made all sorts of references to the cause. They put their own input. They shared their own stories. Every one of them were hilarious, from Raheem and Tony Bird and all. Just amazing. The music was great. The atmosphere was wonderful. Preston, who is the owner of Albella, as always, he's wonderful. And it was well worth the $10 that they asked for yesterday. You left out of there with a bag full of information and connections. Everything about this event was exactly what Simply Sensational Inc. promised it would be. Everybody who was here on Friday heard from Kenny Williams and Sugar Bear. And Sugar Bear was one of the honorees, and he was as wonderful in person as he was on this panel. And everything about this event was worth it. So what I would like to do now is go into our regular shout-outs. That's to Barry Mason, our consultant, formerly of 98.7 Kiss FM Radio in New York, currently with iSoulRadio.com. You can hear him spin his magic on Saturdays from 7 to 10 p.m. and on Sundays from 6 to 10 p.m. When he's not doing that, he too is gracing all of New York City with some great R&B events in the most greatest of venues, including the Albella Lounge at some point. And he was doing that as the CEO of Track One Entertainment Company. I already gave out my shout-outs to Stephanie and Hammond-Tillette and Marcia Morgan. I want to thank the comedians that were out there yesterday, wonderful people to help first that was out there helping us sponsor this event. I want to thank my team, as usual and always. They are wonderful, absolutely wonderful people. They are my co-host, Lady Diamond Elaine Yeves, and our sports co-host, Monster Miles. I want to thank DJ Rodney Williams, DJ Dome Wrecker Rodney Williams, who has been giving us the greatest of his magical mixes. And he is now officially the startup segment of our Saturday Showcase to help give us some of that great musical magic that he has. To PS37, Cynthia Jenkins School in Queens, thank you for allowing us to continue to be rich in going out there and empowering not just our community, but mainly our youth and our parents, and continuing to empower us as a people and our education in our day-to-day social issues, everything. To Terrell Ebony, the parent coach that stood here and helped with us on Monday, everybody that listened in, I want to thank you all very much for the wonderful, 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 encouraging support that you loaned me when I was getting to a difficult time of speaking on my own stories and my daughter's story of surviving crime. And I want to thank Carl Tone Jones. He was one of the people who brought me a new awareness topic, which we'll be discussing on Friday. And he also was a very big supporter. Mark from this wonderful group I'm about to mention, the Real World Black News and Discussions group on Facebook, who has been the majority of my feedback on the pre-broadcast topic question. All of you listened in. Every one of you had something great to say. Every one of you gave us courage to continue and let us know that us sharing our story, as hard as it was worth something. So you know how we do this. We're going to have our early break. When we get back, tonight's topic is part two of our three-part series, Victimization, Rest in Peace. Now, Monday we spoke on the trauma of a crime, being raped, being mugged, being kidnapped, you know, having been at the mercy of a stranger or someone you trusted that might as well have been a stranger. And we spoke on how to deal with being angry and moving on, how to forgive, how to remind yourself that you were a victim, how to acknowledge the fact that you were victimized. That was part one. And that will continue into today, but today's angle is going to be from this part. How do we deal with shaking victimization by trauma or grief? We just found out that we have an illness that may take our life. We just lost a loved one, either by someone's crime or by some sudden situation that nobody can explain, and everything was going great until one crazy moment. So today we're going to be speaking on how do we get past that. And for those of you that have lost loved ones to trauma, to somebody else who came in and never knew you from Adam, but took your child or your father or your mom or your husband or your wife, and you are still dealing with the grief and anger of that, that is going to be something that we're going to be speaking on today, on how we can start to move on from there to honor the loved ones that we lost, and also how to take our life back. So after the break, we are going to start our topic. Now, today's early break topics is by Gloria Estefan, and it's called Can't Forget You, and that is for us honoring our loved ones and also honoring the part of us that used to be before whatever illness took over and made us a different person. So after this break, I'll be back in 4.5 minutes, and we will get this party started.
There's a part of me that's dying every time I hear your name. There's a part of me that's trying to bring back your love again. There are times when I just want to run, but there's no place to hide. Even though my heart is breaking in a million bits inside, I can make believe
I can walk away.
You're listening to On the Edge.
Welcome back, everybody, to the On the Edge show with Katie Barnett and friends. I'm your host, Katie Barnett, and this, ladies and gentlemen, is part two of our three-part series, Victimization, Rest in Peace. On Monday, you heard us speaking on the stories of trauma by crime, hatred, holding on, unforgiveness by crime, how you can be stagnated by what took place and what happened to you, the things that you have to deal with. Well, today we're going to be speaking on that, and we're going to be really angling from another type of victimization, a crime that took a loved one, a crime that or an illness that took away what you once knew life to be. Now, we do have a panelist in, and I'm going to be bringing them in this evening. Just give me 1 second. Welcome to the show, caller. You're on the air.
Hello.
Hello.
Hello. Hey, what's going on, Katie?
Hi, who's this?
This is Professor Carl Tom Jones calling in.
Oh, hi, Carl. Okay, well, I just said thank you to you on the air, so I hope you were in listening to that.
I was indeed. Thanks for having me. I definitely appreciate you.
Thank you very much. You were one of the people that reached out to myself, and, you know, I was able to forward and show my daughter all of the support that she had, even though she's already pretty much, she's well engrossed in her newfound advocacy, so she's good. And I was able to show her just how much extra support she had from people that were listening in and heard her story and my story and were pretty much supportive. You guys were absolutely fantastic with it. All right, well, today I want to be talking about part two of that. And we're speaking because there's a lot of people that I have met, that I've known, and that I've dealt with, and even myself to a point where they just found out that either they have cancer or they have something that could take their life a little later, or it's just going to restrict life as they know it in very big ways. And a lot of people that I know, and I'm happy to say, like with the panelists we had on Friday, Sugar Bear, he found out just a few months ago that he has prostate cancer. And he spoke about how he questioned why. Like, you know, I ate healthy. I was never a person to go out there and, you know, do drugs and things like that. Anything that would cause this to happen. And, you know, but he chose to be more educated about the illness rather than just wallow in that. But he deals with the struggles of that every day. So I want to ask you, do you think, this is the question also for our listeners, this is a two-part question. Do you think that the loss of a loved one or finding out that you have a disease or an illness that can debilitate you or can take your life somewhere down the line, do you think that the fear of that and the anger of that, of knowing, of hearing this, can be more consuming than the actual disease or grief itself? That's the first question. I'll ask you that.
Yes. Well, when you look at it and you analyze the situation, a lot of us have to have some type of drive, or some type of ambition, something to drive towards to get up in the morning, just something that makes life worth living. Get news like that when you lose somebody that's close to you, or you get news that that you may be coming down with an illness and so forth. You know, it can be a debilitating situation, and it can be a situation where you yourself actually lose that drive, that ambition, and that in itself can supersede, you know, whatever effect the illness or the loss of someone that has on you. So I definitely understand that plight. As a therapist, you know, I'm also a therapist in addition to being a professor. I deal with that a lot with my clients where they have to find a reason to go forth. They have to find a reason. And it's a very difficult path because it's different for each and every individual.
It is. I can say that from losing my son. I think grief by, you know, there's two ways that grief is already a problem. One, if it happened because of somebody else. And two, if it happened out of nowhere. Okay, I had a little boy. When he was born, it was great. He was, I ate healthy. He was born 8 pounds, 6 ounces. He was happy. He was, you know, everything was great. I loved him with all my heart. And then I started noticing that he had trouble breathing through his nose. And infants, that's how they breathe. When they're first born, they learn later how to breathe through their mouth, you know, as you go older. But you need to breathe. They need to breathe through their nose at first. So it was like torture for my son. It was trying to breastfeed him was like nearly killing him. Trying to give him a bottle, and he could take like a quarter of a half ounce, and he would be gagging for air, like literally gasping. And I brought him to the hospital 11 times, and I was like, listen, he's not breathing right, okay? And the doctors are telling me, oh, that's because he's a winter baby, and babies in the winter, for some reason, they get super congested and super dry. All you need to do is go home and take this bottle of saline nose drops. Don't worry, Mommy. It's only water and salt, and it'll loosen up the mucus, and it'll take him out. Well, I did this. They said I can do it 2 to 3 times a day. And they said, it won't hurt him. You can do it 4 times a day. Well, it wasn't working. Mucus was not coming out. There wasn't anything. Took him back. And the doctor said, oh, no, you can do it 4 times. You can do it as often as necessary. Well, after my 11th visit the next day, he was dead for 8 hours when I finally, you know, woke up and went to go feed him for his first day, his first feeding of the day. And,
wow.
You know, so many things came from that. Like, well, why didn't anybody know this? And, you know, he was, thank God it wasn't my first child, because if it was my firstborn, I don't think I would have had, he was my first son, but he was my second child. And I had my older daughter, who was still a baby herself, to sort of keep me focused on staying strong. But the grieving process was hell. You know, the grieving process was crazy. Having people come over. Okay, you got background noise over there that's coming out.
No, sorry. I'm on the street, and
down the block. Oh, don't worry. Then if that's something you can't control, we'll try to work through it for now. But I had people, like I spoke about on Monday, come into the house and, like, you know, they're uncomfortable with your grief because, first, it's a sad situation that a baby dies. All right? So
right.
That's the first problem. It's a sad situation that a baby dies. Then we're talking about people looking at a loved one suffering the grief. So they don't know how to handle, you know, not being able to help you while you're grieving. And then instead of just feeling awkward and saying, I really don't know how to help you, so what do you need me to do? They'll try to figure out a way to solve their own problem, and it'll come out totally wrong. Like, I had people tell me when I found out only about 3 weeks after we buried our son that I was pregnant again, and they were like, oh, see, now you don't gotta, you know, now you can be happy again because you have one that's coming to replace him.
And not understanding the damage that they're doing. You know, a lot of times people rush in. They see us. They see a loved one who's hurting. They want to do something because it's a disempowering experience to go through. To feel as though, wow, you know, I care about this person. I don't like to see them hurt. I have to do something. I have to say something to make the situation better. And then what you see is oftentimes people rush into the situation without having any experience in grief counseling, and they say things off the top of their head that, you know, can inflict a lot more damage to the psyche of the person that's going through the grief. It can definitely destroy relationships because once you say something, you can't take it back,
right.
No matter how sorry you are for saying it. It's a rough situation to be in.
You know, that's what we spoke about Monday. I know you were listening in, and I once again, please let me say thank you for that, because the subsequent support that you offered was absolutely phenomenal, and I appreciate it. But what we spoke about when I was sharing my story and the story of my daughter, was people say the darndest things when they're uncomfortable with your discomfort. Do you understand? It's like you really not need, you really, like they say, if you can't say something good, don't say nothing at all sometimes. And we were speaking about how sometimes you just want somebody there to shut up and just be there. So, yeah, you're not actually alone. But for you to tell a parent that lost the baby that they're pregnant again, so it's going to replace the one you lost, that's the wrong thing to say. And I blew up. I did. I mean, I know that, you know, they meant well, and I didn't mean to blow up. But then again, at that moment, I kind of did. But I didn't mean to be so harsh about it. But in my grief, I was harsh. I was like, what are you talking about? No matter how many children I have, it'll always be the one that I lost, you know? So it was like that. I used to kick people out of my house quite a bit. Oh, just get out of here. And, you know, they don't understand that you're talking from what people don't get is that the loss of a child is the worst grief. It's the worst grief. Because, you know, you lose your mom, it's sad, yes. You lose your father, sad, yes. But deep down inside, you expect that the elderly are going to die at some point. You lose a sister or a brother, that's a little bit harder. That's a little bit harder because depending if they were older or younger than you, you guys were in the same time period. So you guys were in the same time period. So, you know, like it's almost like it could have been you. But when you lose a child, the one that you had to extend life beyond yourself, the one that you were in the role of protecting, and that they're so full of life and innocence, and a child always seems like they're going to live forever. When you lose a child, you lose a part of you that's special, that's different, that's untouchable, it's sacred, and you lose life beyond yourself. So you having to bury your child, that is the worst type of grief to deal with and get over, and that I know. So it's like having somebody tell you that those words were to me saying, forget about it. You know, like, all right, look. Go ahead,
Kong. No, it's you know, something, fortunately, you know, I can say I don't know what you feel, how you feel, you know, and I say that from a selfish point of view because I've never had to experience that, but, you know, I've seen it. I've seen it up close. In fact, you know, I created, well, let me get into it real quick. I had a cousin who was murdered right here in the streets of Philadelphia. I believe we talked a little bit about that off the air. And his murder devastated me, but I saw what it did to his parents. I watched his father, who, you know, was a very outgoing, athletic man. I watched him age, I would have to say 30 years overnight, just dealing with the grief of losing, and that was his second son that he lost, you know, at the same age. So, you know, the grief seemed to be unbearable. It was unbearable to me. You know, I went out and created a workshop dedicated to his memory and also dedicated to addressing that situation where we had youths out there not valuing lives. How corrupt our moral system was with our youth at that time. And that actually fostered the workshops and the presentations that I do to this day.
Right, and I could tell you it is devastating. And you know something, you do lose a lot of friendships and relationships. And you do, you know, because the people that is on the receiving end of that grief and that shoot from the hip reaction, okay, they don't understand that you're not personally attacking them. Even if you said something straight up cutting to them, you're talking out of a that type of grief is like, I can't breathe, I can't sleep, I can't walk, I can't stand, I can't do, no matter what you do, it doesn't go away. There were times that about 3 to 6 weeks after my son passed away, every time that it was time for him to wake up to nurse, I swore I heard him and my arms would start hurting where I would hold him to feed him. You know, I felt that. I heard, you know, his cry at night. There were times I could smell him. I could really feel that he was still in the crib. So many things. I didn't want to take the crib down for some time because then that would mean I really would have to say he was there. As a matter of fact, I went to this point, and a lot of the mothers, and I was so glad that I finally got the guts to go to a to a support group, because I was like, what do I want to go over there and hear a whole bunch of other people tell me about how they lost their kid too? I don't want to hear it. It's already sad. You know, this is the type of things I was going through. And what I went through was this. I got there, and I heard people were going through exactly the same things that I thought I was going crazy with as well. My son was 3 months old, just turned 3 months. And funny, his date of death, like it's a caramel joke or something, is April Fool's Day. So the day that we called everybody from the hospital, they were like, I was like, you know, my son passed and my son is dead. And they're like, April Fool, right? Like, would that would ever be a joke you would tell somebody, which is exactly the way I said it. Why the hell would I ever use that as a joke for April Fool's Day? You know, that was the type of things I was saying, because, like, people were saying the most stupidest things, and they're shocked. So when I got there and I hear this woman telling me she literally could feel her arms start to hurt in the position that she would, you know, like, it would hurt the way it would hurt if she was holding the baby. Every time that the breastfeeding time came, every time that he or she would wake up, and you're hearing it, I'm seeing all this grief from people. And I remember that there was two things that happened to me that I thought was cruel on the doctor's part. The way that I found my son, he was asleep. And they didn't teach you back then that you put your babies on their backs. And us, in our mind, we're thinking if you put them on their stomach and they throw up, they'll throw up out. But if they're on their back, I was thinking they'll get choked. I was 18 years old at the time. No, just turned 19. Okay, so I was brand new to this. And this is like, I already had two kids. I had my first one at 18, and the second one, no, 19 and 20. So they were back to back, and I didn't, you know, I didn't really have a lot of training, but I knew I had a lot of love and what I was going to do, so all right. So I'm thinking that the best way to protect your child from choking is if they're on their stomach. They could lift their head and, you know, or move their head and it'll go out to the side. No, not so, said the cat of the MD circle, you know. But they tell you that after. Then to find out that your child died to something that happens to 1,000 babies a year and that your child was one of the thousands, that was another thing I went through. But what that morning, I kept waking up. The night before, my son kept crying. So it was 11:30, and I'll never forget it. He would not stop crying. He was fed. He was bathed. He was rocked. He was dry. It was cool. You know, nothing soothed him. And about a couple of hours before, and his father was always in trouble. He kept staring at his father, who was about to go out yet again. Like no matter what you did, this baby kept on straining his head to look dead at his father. Like, all the signs were there. But, you know, he kept straining to look dead at his father like he knew it was going to be the last time that he saw him. He was only 3 months old, and it was amazing. Like, his grandmother was a live-in domestic worker, and she would come home on the weekend, and she came to come see him, and he would not pay her any mind. And then that night, about 11:35, I kept on trying to get him to calm down, and he wouldn't. I couldn't rock him. The breastfeeding wasn't working. The formula wasn't working. Nothing worked. And so I kept saying to myself, baby, please, you got to go to sleep. Mommy's very tired, and you got to go to sleep. And I said, I don't know what to do for you, you know? So I said, everybody kept saying, you know how all your Southern people and all your old elder people, they always have advice. Oh, you better put that baby down because you're going to spoil them. Oh, no, you're going to pick him up. You're going to spoil him. And I felt like, I don't want to spoil my child, but he's crying. But I had to put him down. I said, maybe they're right. Maybe if he's crying because, you know, if I'm going to keep him up and hold him, anything. You know, at being 19 and 20, you think you know everything. You don't know a damn thing. And I was rocking him for an hour. And I said, baby, you got to go to sleep. What is going on? You're dry. You're not burped. You need to be burped. He finally, I put him on his stomach, and I told myself, no, I'm going to be strong, and I'm not going to pick him up because sometimes babies just need to cry. So I just kept rubbing his back, and he finally fell asleep. And I finally got to go to bed. And at 4 o'clock in the morning, every 15 minutes on the nose, I kept waking up and didn't know why. I kept waking up and I didn't know why. I got up at 4 o'clock, Nothing was going on. I realized his father wasn't home yet. I figured he was running the streets and doing something he shouldn't do. Somebody's going to call and tell me that he was in jail or something like that. Fine, I went back to sleep. Got up at 4:15. Same thing, what's going on? The kids are asleep, what's the matter? Back to sleep, 4:30, all the way to 7 o'clock in the morning. Just so happened that my brother's wife was staying with me to help me with the babies for the first week. And when I got up at 7 o'clock, the way we used to do it was, if one baby, if we were both up, whichever baby I had, she would go help with the other one. So I went to go pick up my older daughter because she had sweat. She was sweating and she peed the bed, and I had to, you know, change her diaper and everything. She was dealing with the baby, and all I heard her say was, "Oh my God, Kate, the baby's not breathing." And I said, "What?" And I said, "No, no, no." So like my heart started pounding, and I'm looking at her, and I was like, "You got to be kidding me!" Like no. She says, "No, really, he's not breathing." Now she had lifted him up and saw his face was blue, but she freaked out and she let him go back down and she put him back on his stomach. So I said, "No, no, 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 no. He's got his sister's oversized sleeper on. You can't see his stomach moving up and down." So now this is what I'm saying to you, is that I went through convincing myself that I didn't see what I see, while my heart already knew that I saw what I saw. So I was back and forth in my house first. So then I'm like, okay, it's not that. The sleeper's too big. It's too baggy. So they don't see it. So I went to pick him up. When I turned my son over, my son was a marble. It was like a marble in his face. And I said, okay, no. See, no, this is not happening. So what I did was I lifted his eyes because he was asleep. I lifted his eyes, and his eyes were not moving. They looked straight through me. It was just dark. No movement, no fluttering, nothing. It was just dark. And my heart skipped a beat, but I said to myself, no. See, I think I know CPR because I just saw it on the movies. So I did. When I blew in his mouth, blood came out his nose. Now I freaked out. So I'm screaming, and I'm running out the door, and I'm screaming for somebody to help me. My phone was down at the time. Everything was just crazy. The father wasn't home. I was running crazy. The neighbors came. So when the neighbors came, I'm screaming. I'm screaming, and I'm crying, but no tears could come down because my mind would not believe that I'm seeing what I'm seeing, okay? So my mind is saying to me, I know what I see, but my heart's like, nope. Okay, well, the paramedics came finally. So I'm like, see, they're going to know what they're doing because I'm just a mother. What do I know? I don't know anything. They started working on him. So my heart's like, see, they're going to do something. Well, they were pumping him. Nothing happened. Now my mind's going, he's dead. That's it. Until she said, we're going to go to the hospital. So then my mind said, okay, see, they're only EMTs. What do they know? We're going to the hospital now. We're going to the hospital. And the doctors are definitely know what to do. Well, we got to the hospital. And I remember I had one leg on in my pants. I had my bra halfway out with my shirt halfway on, and I was in the ambulance, and I was screaming, but I couldn't cry tears yet. Like, I'm screaming. And I'm going, you know, oh, my God. And she's like, you get in the back now. And I cannot help your son. Would you be panic? Get in the back right now. And so I get in the back, and I'm sitting there, and I'm seeing them put the tiniest oxygen mask I've ever seen over his face, and still nothing. So we get to the hospital, and the doctors push me out of the way, and these big, burly security guards came to calm me down, and they locked me in this room where they take, like, the criminally insane, and they locked me in the room. But I looked back, and I saw they were pumping my son, and his body was going up and coming down lifeless. But still, I'm saying, nope. They're going to fix them. But my mind is saying, come on, stop being stupid. You know what you see. I'm like, no. So they say it. Nope. So finally, they came in, and these nuns came in. It was a Catholic hospital. These nuns came in, and I was in the center. I swear it was like an execution. Like, everybody was standing around me in a circle, and I was on this bar stool in the middle of the circle. And these nuns came in and just started rubbing my back. They didn't say a word. And then the doctors come in, and they're asking me these questions. Was there any problems with breathing in the family? I'm like, yes, we have asthma all over the place, and my brother had his adenoids taken out. And he's going, well, did you notice anything in the baby? I said, yes, I told the doctors 11 times that he couldn't breathe through his nose. Well, was there any other thing? So they're asking me. So my head is going, what is going on with my son? Oh, I know. They're going to tell me that he has some terminal illness. Selfish as I was at the time, I would rather that he be alive at that time with a terminal illness, right, rather than he died. So I'm convincing myself that that's what they were going to say. Well, finally, after the 59 questions, and I counted them, 59 questions, they asked me about medical history. They finally said, you know your baby passed away, don't you? And Carl, that was when the tears came down. That was when all the screaming I did, all of the sobbing without the tears, it was like somebody put it real to my head, and it started. I started to just bawl my eyes out. Then we got to the funeral part, the part where now you have to go, you know, arrange for your baby to be buried. And I wanted to just be there for everything because that was still my son. That was it. It was my baby. It was just my baby. So you know what? It's still what he's dead. It's my baby. He looks like a baby. He's my baby. I don't care. And my godbrother was the undertaker. And he said to me, listen, Kay, I know you're not going to understand this now. I get it, sweetheart. You're grieving. This is your baby. But you don't want to be there to put his T-shirt on. Please let me do that. And you could dress him the rest of the way because the last thing that you're going to want to remember when you get over this moment of grieving is seeing the autopsy scar on your son's body. So please let me put his onesie on, okay? And I promise you, you could dress him the rest of the way. I dressed him. I dressed him. I was kissing my baby. I was doing everything. And they kept, my father was like, you're going to breathe in the formaldehyde. And I would tell him, get away from me. This is not formaldehyde. This is my child. Get out of my face. Okay, that's the way it was. And then we got to the funeral. And I was still looking at my son dressed in his beautiful tuxedo in the box full of beautiful lace, but he was still my baby until we got to the burial ground. And that's when it all became real. All the way up to that point, he was still my son. And then when we got to the grave, that was when it all became real. And then the grief after that, where now you don't have a physical connection anymore, you can't touch them, you can't look at them, now you have to start dealing with the fact that this was a death. This was a death. And this is a death that happens to 999 other babies, and you got to deal with it. And nobody could tell you why, not no expert, not the people who studied this. Nobody could tell you exactly what makes these babies go to sleep and never wake up again. But one thing that they did give me was, being that I had started to see a couple of little things in him, that it was going to be very likely he was going to grow up and have some massive respiratory blockage that was going to cause him pain. So to this day, one of the things that helped me start to accept the death was that, A, my spiritual belief is that babies are instant angels, and B, he was going to suffer if I let him, if my wish came true, and he lived. So the grief that you have to deal with that, the grief you go through and have people say stupid things, okay, that they don't mean to be stupid, that's part that causes that anger to consume you, and you look at that person for life and go, I remember when you said this about my baby. You got to start letting that go. So Carl, as a therapist, what are some of your suggestions in that respect?
Well, and, you know, I can see that, you know, even 20-something years later, that never really leaves you. And the one thing that I often try to get my clients to understand is that the grief or the actual event, sometimes it won't leave you. We have to learn how to live with the memory, and we also have to learn how to continue our lives. because, you know, unfortunately, and it's a very cold thing to say, but life has to go on because we still have other obligations to other people. We still have an obligation to ourselves. So especially if you have a family that's caring and then you have other children, you know, try to focus the attention on to those needs, but also giving yourself a respite, a chance to grieve, because only you know when you are at that point where you're ready to stop grieving and you're ready to heal. No one can prescribe that. There's not a medical journal that can accurately depict it, you know. So basically, you have to tell everyone to take things at their own pace when they're dealing with such a grievous situation such as this, because there's no one right answer. There's no correct answer. It's all dependent on the individual, their connection, how it transpired, what they feel as though was their part situation, and how can they move forward from there. And it always is always going to have to be one day at a time, one step at a time, and until you get to that point where you're able to actually look forward and to resume your normal, your regular activities.
That's something I can say from a victim, from a healthcare victim standpoint. That's true. And you're absolutely right with what you said. You never get over losing your loved one. You never do. God didn't design us with the ability to forget. He gave us the ability to forgive, and we have to make the choice to do that. I had plenty of people that I had to ask forgiveness from and give forgiveness to. So that was one thing. Now let's speak on somebody losing a child to a crime. Okay, you heard my story about my daughter. I didn't lose her physically, thank the good Lord, you know, to death. But the little girl that they took was gone when she came back, and I felt like he killed my daughter's spirit, the person that was there. But she came back, she grew up to be able to tackle her own demons from it and actually advocate for other girls who suffered it. But I had to forgive that. I lost a godbrother who was more like a brother to me to a girl that he wanted to break up with because she was just a spoiled brat pretty much, and she was horrible to him. He went to go be a gentleman and say goodbye in person, and he gave her things. She had set him up for her mafia father to pretty much shoot him all up. So he was gone. I lost a best friend at five. I was five at the time. That her father murdered her and her mother and put them in a bathtub full of water. So those type of things I had to, like, why? I was angry with everybody. Like, how do you look at me and say that it's okay for you to do that? How do you look at me and be like, I want to get out on parole after you took a 12-year-old girl from a bus stop? You know, that was what I went through. How do you want to go? How could you dare say you don't understand why you're being arrested? How could you sit there and make a conscious effort every day to plan to pick somebody off their school grounds to sell them into prostitution?
Yeah, that's a very difficult situation for anybody to be in, and then to deal with. I mean, you're talking about if a person went through any one of those situations, any one of those scenarios, you're talking about trauma. You're talking about depression kicking in later on. You know, you know, you're talking about a lot of different traumas, and then to experience all that at once, the one individual to experience all of those things, that's very, very difficult for a person to come back from. How do you forgive those things? How do you forgive yourself? And like I said earlier, there's no one answer. You know, one of the steps I would, you know, definitely look at is to get the individual to say, and the individual is you in this instance, but just to say that we're talking about John Doe or Jane Doe or whoever we're talking about here, I would get them to look at how their feeling is affecting them, you know, in terms of carrying this grudge, does it affect you or does it affect the individual you're carrying the grudge towards? When you carry the anger, when you carry the pain, how it affects you. And what we would try to do is work on building you back up. And if there is, listen, sometimes anger, grief, remorse, all those things show that you're human. You know, I would be afraid of somebody if they told me that they have no feelings, no remorse to a situation, because that means you're losing your touch of reality. You're losing that the thing that makes you human. You know, and that's how a lot of people become, you know, sociopaths and psychopaths out here, because, you know, you lose touch with those things that you, with your feelings, with your emotions. And once we lose touch with those, then, you know, we're not going to be very predictable in terms of our future actions. So that's some of the things that I would venture upon, is trying to build that person back up, to build them back up to, so that they can see that, you know, they can love themselves, that they can forgive themselves. A lot of times we are angry with ourselves for what happened. Why didn't I step in and do this? Why didn't I protect somebody from that? And we have to, you know, understand that sometimes you can do everything right and something still will go wrong, you know.
Absolutely.
So it's very difficult, and let's face it, not everybody recovers. You know, if everybody recovered, then we'd be talking about, you know, we'd be putting this stock on Wall Street, you know, in terms of the treatment. Not everybody recovers. And but it's a blessing that you have recovered to the point where you're free to talk about it now, and you're free to also lend your platform to others, because, and as we spoke about this privately, you know, I hope you don't mind me saying, you speaking on your vulnerabilities, things that made you vulnerable, gives other people strength, such as when you went to that support group and you saw other people that were going through what you were going through, you were able to gain strength from that, because now you're no longer alone. You know, you have somebody in this fight with you. So you talking about this on the air, you bringing this out, and your daughter talking about this, this gives people strength. And this also gives them, you know, the ability to say, hey, listen, if they're doing it, you know, then I can do it too. It's not impossible to overcome these situations that we're dealing with. And that's a very important thing, because a lot of times in these situations, you get isolated.
Right.
You know, you fall apart.
I do have a couple of callers that's been waiting online, so just hang with me so I can come back to your point. One second, okay? Welcome to the show, caller, and thank you for waiting. You're on the air.
Hi, Katie. This is Ron.
Hey, Ron, how are you?
All right.
Hi.
I came in on the Sid's moment, so I caught everything from the scar on the chest and the onesie on all that stuff. So I'm caught up.
Yes, pretty much I was speaking about an example of grief that, you know, of grief of losing a loved one to something sudden or to a crime. And, you know, how that, you know, can that anger and fear, and people that have been diagnosed with like a terminal illness, the anger and fear of the disease. My question is a two-part question today. Do you think that somebody can be so angry and so grievous or in fear of either the illness or the grief that it'll actually be more consuming of them than the actual loss of the loved one or the illness itself? Answer that question for me.
My, that's a mouthful. the grief you described was quite overwhelming, since you also experienced that devil who took away your little girl. So I can easily see how you can be overcome with the grief. That's why you have to keep your eyes on a higher goal. That is, remember, there is God in this world. However, if you remember there's God in this world, there's the devil. So God allows the devil to have his reign. Sometimes it seems a lot more than he should, but there is a balance. And I force myself to believe that there is a balance, and we'll get rid of all those devils. Not all at once, but one by one.
Okay, so your suggestion, that's part two. What would you suggest people do, like to get on that part? Oh, I see you there. I'll bring you in a minute.
Mm-hmm.
What would you suggest from your standpoint, mm-hmm. what would you think would be a good thing to tell somebody that just got discovered that they have cancer, mm-hmm. or somebody mm-hmm. like me who lost their child out of nowhere? Now, it's been 23 years, and I'm at the point now, I've been at the point for a while, but I mean now I could actually take it specifically for advocacy,
mm-hmm.
okay, where I couldn't do that before. I wasn't allowed to grieve back then. There was ACS mm-hmm. involved or Child Protective Services because my friend died at home and I lived in a poor black neighborhood. So mm-hmm. in their mind, I had to have committed the murder or I must have mm-hmm. done something. So I had to deal with that as well. I didn't mm-hmm. get time to sit there and grieve with the time that it happened. I had to wait till after all that was out the way and still try to keep my mind out and not act like I was grieving or crying or crazy in case these people
mm-hmm.
used that. It was like a whole bunch of things. But I'm here now, and I can talk about him, and now I can do what normal mothers do, cry at every Christmas or every birthday and say he would have been, and then move on. And every date of death, I'll plant flowers. That I can do. I couldn't do that before. It was a part of me. It was embedded in me. It was my breath. When I breathed, I felt the pain. When I saw a kid that even though I had seven more after him, it was still that one. So it stayed with me for some time.
Mm-hmm.
And I always talk about him because I always feel like I don't want people to forget that he existed. So that I always bring up. And I tell my younger children, your older brother, you know, you had an older brother and he passed. But now it's not the grievous, gloomy way that it used to be before. There's
mm-hmm.
not that dark shadow anymore. It's like now I can look at him and say, I've got an angel up there watching over me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so that now I can see it that way, and I was the mother of one of God's angels. That's how I see it, and that helped me quite a bit. So your suggestion would be, what do you think would be something that people can do to start getting away from being consumed by anger and fear?
Well, I'll answer it like this. When I was younger, there was a group we're part of. This is like when I was 11, 12. They called the Human Relations Club, and the goal of the club was to get you to experience something different that normally you wouldn't experience. And in my situation, in a depressed area, that is the black kids were several grades behind the white kids of the same level. So in my example, they'd send the kids away to a white kid's school. Also seventh grade, but they'd learn things that you would never learn because you're in a black neighborhood. So more or less on your situation, you should befriend new friends who are in your physical locale as well as situation. That is it. They're having happy and bad times, as everyone does, but they have lots of good times. Like they have something to contrast your darkness. That way you can learn, you can focus on more goodness. That is, let's say, the birth of a child. When the child starts 11th grade, when the child graduates high school, you know, goodness, happiness. That way, instead of associating with individuals who say, I've also experienced the darkness and I can attest that there are several demons in the world, which there are. I mean, you can get with other individuals who will have good as well as bad. That is, you'll develop a different outlook instead of why am I being punished? Haven't I suffered enough? I mean, there are good things out there and good people, and over time, you'll start attracting that goodness, that light to your life. So instead of reflecting on the bad, dark stuff all the time, I mean, with these new people and new individuals, I mean, they'll shed some of their light on you. So by association, your life will become brighter. I mean, you won't feel as if you have a emotional anchor connected to you, you know, suffering
Absolutely.
Through life.
That
that's how I think that would be best for you to do, something like that.
That's definitely a good point, and I'm going to bring in another panelist, and while he comes in, Paul, from the professional standpoint, do you feel that what he said has some merit?
Well, I definitely agree that it helps to counsel other people. One of the things I'll be careful of, though, is just because you're a victim of a particular crime or a victim of a particular trauma doesn't necessarily make you an expert in dealing with those who are, you know, facing a similar trauma or a similar situation. So I will be careful. I will err on the side of caution on dealing with that aspect of it. Spiritually, you also have to be careful because everybody is not spiritual. Sometimes you may run into somebody who may, you may run into an atheist or a person who doesn't share your religious or spiritual beliefs, and that can cause conflict. But overall, you know, surrounding yourself with people who want to change or people who are in need and thinking that feel as though they can go through a situation together, that often does help because, once again, you have allies. You're no longer fighting this battle alone, you know. So in that aspect, I could definitely see where that can help out a situation. So that's kind of where I would go with that.
I agree. I'll call it on the panel. Just hang on 1 second. I also wanted to touch on what you just said, Carl, about being careful with spiritual, relations, I guess, because a lot of times in the grieving process, while you're speaking about, you know, the Lord will deliver you, they're blaming God for what happened. So at that particular moment, you're right. I was, thank you, Lord, was not one of them. I actually turned to God and said, I don't know why you did this. I mean, I don't know why this had to happen. I'm not going to ask, but I do need for you to please give me the strength to be strong for my daughter, because I did have an older daughter at the time who was only a year old. So it was like that. Welcome to the show, caller. You're on the air.
Good evening, panel. How is everybody? God bless everyone and their family.
Good evening, Deacon. Thank you for holding and listening in over there. I took a little while. I'm sorry.
Hey, Deacon.
Hey, how's it going?
Okay.
All right, ma'am.
Carl, this is Deacon Zeddy Williams. Deacon Zeddy Williams, this is Carl. He's a therapist, and he's also someone that's on the group that we belong to on Facebook.
Okay. How's everyone? I am blessed and highly favored, that is for sure.
All right, now.
Okay, Deacon, tell us what you think
about
the next topic.
About what?
All right. Well,
this is
a two-part question. Tonight's topic. Today, you know that this is a three-part series of victimization. Rest in peace. You were here Monday, so you know we spoke on specifically people who were directly a victim of crime. Today, I want to talk about it from two different angles. People who are a victim of trauma or grief, meaning trauma because they just found out they got cancer. Like, you know, Sugar Bear was here Friday, and he spoke about all the things he went through and how he felt, like, you know, why me or what next. And Ms. Carla McLean was there, Mr. McLean. Also, people who are loved ones of a victim of a crime, lost a loved one to crime or something sudden. Now, what I brought up was I brought up the fact that I lost a son to a suddenness in death. No real warning, and then he was gone. Some people have lost a loved one to somebody having a fight with someone in the store, and their stray bullet got this person who wasn't even in the fight.
Mm-hmm.
So with those type of examples being on the table, my first question is, do you feel that the anger and fear of an illness that they may have found out they have, or the grief of the loss of a loved one, could that be so much more consuming than the actual loss or fear itself, the disease itself? Do you think that can happen?
Yeah, I think it's very possible that it can happen. First of all, just let me say this. I am, and I'm very proud of it, I am a very spiritual person, and I truly believe that that God does not give us the spirit of fear, and he gives us the strength to be able to deal with anger. We are always in a spiritual battle with the enemy, who is the devil, and it's not that you get a break at it at any time, because we're always in a constant war. You know, so the only thing that I can say is it, with my belief and my faith is that I do a lot of praying, so I may have bruised knees because I stay on my knees a lot, because I've had to deal with some tragic deaths in my family. I've lost 2 godsons, 3 nephews, 2 nieces, and the 2 nieces I lost all in the same year. One just recently was 19 years old. Her name was Cregene Bell. She was shot and killed by her 18-year-old boyfriend, ex-boyfriend, because she no longer wanted to be bothered with him. And she was trying to get away from him. They had been broken up for about 6 months. He started giving her threatening phone calls and threatening to do things to her friends and stuff if she didn't agree to meet with him. So this one day she decided to meet with him. She was with her best friend. And he called and told her, said, well, if you don't come where I am, I'm coming to look for you. On this day happened on November the 18th of 2012. So she agreed to meet him over on this street called Cottage, over on Cottage Street here in Toledo. She was in her car. He came over to the car and started talking to her. She was in fear of him, so she just partially rolled down her window. And he asked her to get out of the car. She wouldn't get out of the car because she said, you know, she could always tell when he was going to do something violent to her. And I had no idea, none of the rest of the family didn't know that he had been beating her for over 6 months in the relationship. And he started kicking on the outside of the door. And when he saw that she wasn't going to get out of the car, he pulled out a 9mm and started shooting her while she was in the car. She was trying to get out of the car to run. She made it out of the car. He was still shooting her while he was walking up on her. She ran and up on these people's steps. And come to find out, the steps that she was running up was his family members. And they had surveillance cameras, and they sat in the house and watched this murder. She was shot a total of 9 times. He emptied this 9mm and then reloaded. When she got up on the porch, was banging on the door, he walked up on the porch behind her. He had already shot her several times and walked up behind her and shot her in the head, in the back of the head. Then the people inside the house opened the door and he drug her body inside the house. He came back out on the porch, and then to make it look like it was some type of retaliation or a drive-by, he shot himself in the leg and tried to claim that it was a drive-by shooting that they were shooting at them. She fought for her life for 3.5 hours. But the doctor said that she would be no more than a vegetable if she would have lived. And I know God wouldn't want her to be living on this earth like that. Just 3 weeks ago, he was sentenced to 20 years to life without the chance of parole. Like I said, you know, it'll take me some time to forgive him, and I know I will be able to, but God is still working on me with that. But what I can say is that if you have faith, it doesn't take a whole lot. Just a little faith, you can get through anything, because we can do all things through Christ Jesus. And I'm a true believer in that, because I'm still here. There was a point to where I'm really not supposed to be here, because I died. I was gone for 7.5 hours. My heart and brain functions and everything stopped. And I was supposed to be paralyzed from the chest down, but my faith in God. And I know that he had another plan where the doctor said that I was supposed to be in one way. But when you're trying to deal with tragedy and loss, it's a struggle. You have to have a very good support group around you, people that really care about you and really love you, and they love you enough to back away when you really need it. Some people, they just want to be up in your face constantly, but there comes a time where you just need people to just back off and just let you be for a little while. Not leaving you alone, but just back away and let them grieve in their own way. It's a process, and it's not something that you could just jump up and say, okay, I'm fine, because it doesn't work that way. You guys have to excuse me.
No, brother. You know, what you're saying is powerful and similar to Katie's story is, you know, you're showing people that you can deal with situations like this, that there is a time when we can come back from this, where this isn't the end of the story.
Right.
And I think that's a very, very powerful message. You know, I'm sitting here listening, and, you know, one of the things that I talked to Katie about when we spoke on the phone at length a couple of days ago was that, you know, one of the things we have to also recognize, too, is, you know, the seasonal anxiety and the seasonal depression that we might face. And,
right.
You know, when we deal with trauma at specific times of the year, you know, how we may not even be thinking about it, but because your subconscious is aware of the environment around you, you know, your subconscious is aware of the circumstances that led to the trauma, subconsciously, you start to relive a lot of those emotions. You start to relive a lot of those, you start to get that fog, even that mental blaze where you're not quite sure what's going on, and you're not quite aware of why you're going through this. You're going through a funk, and you're not quite aware of it. And due to a lot of times we're dealing with the seasonal anxiety, and I think a lot of us need to be made aware of it. And just as you say, you know, when we deal with situations, it takes time, and nobody can tell you how your clock ticks or how you will heal when you're dealing with a situation like this. And thankfully enough, you have that spiritual base that helps you, that you can lean on to help you deal with. We all know, especially those of us who have been through something, that some days are better than others. And there's sometimes when we need that time for something to hold us up, something that we can lean on or fall back on and say, thank you, I'm glad that you have me. For some of us, it's our spirituality. For some of us, it's our family. For some of us, it's our close friends. For some of us, unfortunately, for some of us, you know, we find out that the parachute won't open.
Right.
Unfortunately, and that's the unfortunate part about this too, is that it doesn't work for everybody. But we're really thankful for the people that like you guys that can give somebody some hope, because as you said earlier, good brother, it takes just a little bit of faith. Just a little bit of faith sometimes is all you need to crack that door. Crack that door when you see that opportunity where you can draw some strength and move forward.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And one of the things that you had touched on just a few minutes ago was that you said, hold on a minute. My foot caught in a wire over here, guys. Hang on a second.
Hey, sorry.
What was that?
We'll help you out. We're friends more. Hold on.
Okay. I was saying that, you do have to go to other people. You're right. You know, you're not all the time you're an expert, like you said, just because you're a victim of it. You're an expert on counseling people. No. One of the things that helped us, my daughter and myself, and as well as, with the grief of my son, was it wasn't that we were trying to counsel the other. We were just sort of going through it. And what happened was that each of us, we were able to learn something about the same exact experience, but from a different perspective from each other. And we both got to cry through it. And that's the thing. One of the things that I wanted to add to this little circle of breaking the cycle, I had a little packet here that I made up. We all brought out from Monday and we spoke about. One of the things is people tend to think that there's a timeline for grieving. Now, to a point there is, meaning if you're still walking around after like 90 years of, you know, things happening and you haven't moved further from that point, yeah, something is seriously, you know, in need of repair. But you never do get over the grief of a loved one. You don't. You don't get over the loss of a loved one. You think about them every day or every time a song that you knew that person liked came on, you know, you'll think about it. Every time you ate a certain food or had a tradition that was by that person, you'll remember it. So you're not going to forget it. So the first thing that you need to do in that respect is acknowledge that. And this is speaking from someone that had to go through it, and this is the thing that all of us came to agreement with. You first have to acknowledge that you're never going to forget it. And that whatever it was, it's always going to be a bad thing that it happened. But the next thing that you do is you start, if it was an older person, like, for example, Deacon, your daughter was, your niece was 19. So you had quite a bit of knowledge of who she was, the person. So you start to know what about that person would she have wanted for us to do. You know, would she have wanted us to continue to be angry with the person who did it? Would she have wanted us to be crying all the time? Or would she have been a person that if she had saw you upset, she would have came and made a joke or did something to get your attention and make you laugh? Those are the type of things that eventually you got to start saying that, how am I honoring this person by being this upset if she loved me or he loved me that much to want me happy? Now, it sounds like something corny in a novel, but it isn't. You know what? Let me bring in our co-host because she's been sitting there listening nicely for 1 second. Hold on. Lady Diamond, are you with us? Wait, her mic is still...
Hello, do you hear me?
Yeah, okay, the mic took a little while to unmute. So, okay, you know what? Before I continue, let's hear what you have to say about tonight's topic.
The grieving matter?
Yeah, well, do you think, not just grief, let's talk about, like, somebody just found out they're diabetic and they know that they don't know what the disease is about or whatever, but they think it means you ate too much sugar. You know, and now they're like, well, why did this happen to me? All they know is the bad side effects or the results of it or what could happen. That's what I do notice about a lot of people that just found out they have an illness. Okay, the first thing you think about is that, like, I had an issue with my heart. The first thing I heard when they told me that was happening with me was, oh, my God, I'm going to have a heart attack. Oh, God, heart attack's coming. You know, so... The first thing that you deal with is the fear of what you were just told. It's the most morbid sounding thing. You're never really familiar with the positive side of that you could actually live with this thing and there's things to do to avoid things happening. You're never thinking about that. You're always thinking about what it is and what could happen from it.
Right.
So my question is, when a person finds out that they have some major illness or they lost a loved one to another person's crime or a sudden factor. Do you think that the fear and anger over the disease or the loss and grief of losing your loved one could be more overwhelming than the actual event itself?
Well, I've had diabetes for a very, very long time. I had it since the age of 6. And let's put it this way. If I could put my mother on the phone so she could explain it, it would be great, you know. But I know how she is. She's, like, you know, a bit shy about it. So
if she's there,
I'm going to go back. Yeah, she's here. And she's just walking around, walking away from me right now, but she would explain it better than I would. And I was diagnosed with diabetes before that, I had a lot of symptoms. And it was urinating a lot. I was thirsty. I was drinking all the time. Almost gave me hand signals. So I was drinking all the time. I wasn't eating anything. So I lost a lot of weight. So I'm 6 years old, and I was really, really, really skinny. And I lost a lot of weight because my blood sugar was super high. And I didn't know that. So my mother, she took me to a doctor who, it was down here in Gwinnett Hospital, and he refused to give me a blood test because he was going by my old blood results. So he called my mother overprotective that, she, you know, she doesn't know what she's talking about. There's nothing wrong with me. That I'm completely healthy. And meanwhile,
right.
I was still losing a massive amount of weight, and I was getting sicker by the day. I remember being little and lying down on the floor and not knowing what's going on. I would go into the bathroom, and I would just lie down. I would pass out on the floor and not know why. I would be dizzy in my classroom. So I was really, you know, I was completely out of it. So my mother, after so many times going to my regular doctor and having him put her down, calling her overprotective side that she doesn't know what she's doing, refusing blood tests, she took me to a private doctor away from Gwinnett Hospital. And this private doctor, all he did was check my urine. And from that urine sample, they took me straight to the emergency room in which they put me in intensive care unit, putting so many needles on me. I'm never going to forget that. They put so many needles on me, trying to find my veins because I was so dehydrated. I was skinny. I lost a lot of weight because of diabetes. And when they checked my blood sugar, it was over 600.
Wow.
So I was close to going into a diabetic coma, if we could put it that way. I stayed in the hospital for like a week. They had to train me. They had to show my mother and my mother really to learn how to give me insulin and check my blood sugar every single day. I know put my mother through a lot of problems. Because now, to this day, when I came out of the hospital, she went straight to that doctor that refused to check my blood, and she told him, you know, my daughter is a diabetic. She's a juvenile diabetic now, and because of you, she was close to dying. And if I ever see you again, you know, this is the usual mom thing, you know, because I would do the same thing. She said, if I ever see you again, I will push you in front of a bus.
Right.
You know, it put my mother through a lot of problems and stress because of that one doctor, you know, and because I was sick, he refused to help me. I can only imagine that if my mother didn't go to the next doctor to see what was wrong with me, I wouldn't be around right now.
Mothers don't do that.
Yeah. So my mother, she's gone through a lot because of me, and yeah, I've gone through my ups and downs with my blood sugar dropping and getting, you know, I had my blood sugar so high that I would start getting sick, throwing up. But right now, I've had it. I'm going to be 33 next month. I had it since I was 6. You know, and this doctor's still around to this day. And my mother will point him out to me. She's like, see that man over there? He's across the street right now because I will push him in front of the bus. And I was still laughing about it. I said, wow, you know, I would like to approach this doctor and say, you know what? Thank you for not helping my mother. But then I decided not to. You know, I mean, my mother has gone through a lot because of me. I wouldn't be alive today if it wasn't because of her. If it wasn't because of her and because of the doctor that helped me out.
Well, we will be celebrating her mother's real soon. I want to ask you a question, Elaine, as a direct patient, okay? Was there ever a time in your life that having diabetes restricted you in some way that made you angry with being afflicted with it?
Well, when I was, I could say when I was a teenager, when I was like 12, 13 years old, yeah, I've gone through my little depression thing that I felt that my diabetes was in my way. I wasn't able to eat cake. I was, you know, whenever I'm invited to a birthday party, I couldn't have soda. They didn't have regular soda. They had juices. They had cakes. So I couldn't eat any of that stuff. You know, I had to eat dietetic cake, dietetic, you know, cookies, or even diet sodas that time. And it was hard to go into birthday parties like that, and I hated it. I'm gonna, you know, I was like 12 years old, even younger. Once I was diagnosed, it was like hard. And to the point that I felt that I wasn't invited to birthday parties because of my illness, because of my diabetes. And I cannot say that it's an illness. I can't say it's a sickness. I mean, I'm 32 years old right now, and you want to take it as a blessing. I'm happy that I don't eat any of the junk food. I'm happy for that. I don't drink soda. I've been soda free for, it'll be 11 years right now. I've been soda free for 11 years. And you know what? I am happy. You know, I take it as a blessing more. You know, I take better care of myself. You know, when I was younger, it's not like diabetes, this is what a lot of people do not understand. Diabetes is not, it's not because, I ate so much sugar when I was little. I didn't eat much sugar when I was little. I was the way I am right now. I didn't eat much sugar. I was a sugarholic. I always shoved chocolate down my throat or candy or, you know, ate sugar, you know, cereals or ate regular, drink regular soda every day. No, I wasn't that type of kid. I was more of like a health conscious kid for some reason. But then with me, it was hereditary. It ran in my family, you know, and that's what type of diabetes is. It's hereditary. It runs in the family. And that's what I didn't understand much when I was younger. I didn't understand that. I didn't understand how can it skip two generations and I end up getting it. I didn't understand that at all. But then since I'm older, yes, I do have a better vision of it. When I was younger, I didn't know anything. Like I said, I didn't know much about it, and I was still learning. I hated it. I hated it when I was young. I didn't want to be around with more people than that. I imagine taking 4 shots a day, insulin shots a day, to the point that when I was 21 years old, they were going to increase my shots to 6 to 8 times a day, and that was crazy. That was too much for me. I can't inject myself with insulin 6 to 8 times a day. It was too much. It was like because to the point that my body stopped reacting to certain insulin. And so right now I'm on the insulin pump. So it gives me insulin 24/7. All I have to do is just change the infusion set, and that's it. I'm good. You know, every other day I have to change it. I have to check my blood sugar at least 4 to 5 times a day, which is way better than injecting myself with insulin 8 times a day when I was 22 years old. You know, so I mean, right now I fall in love with my diet. When I was younger, yes, I fall in love with it, but I didn't know why. I didn't want to. I was a teenager. I wanted to be a teenager. And you know what? Those little restrictions didn't stop me at all. It didn't stop me from playing softball. It didn't stop me from cheerleading. It didn't stop me from gymnastics. It didn't stop me from ballet. It didn't stop me from anything. You know, so little things like that, I overcame it.
Now, you see, you just brought up something that is actually one of the things that we know to be part of us suggesting of breaking the cycle of that. One of the things, as I mentioned earlier, usually I notice that when people find out that they have, like, say, like the disease, the one that the doctors are talking about, the one you see on TV, the one everybody's heard of, you got it. And then all people hear is the name of the disease, what it's about, and what happened. One of the things that we were able to start talking to people about that are victims of like fear and anger to a disease is this. Before you start to look at the down the road, why don't you have to get educated about what is going on with you and how it actually works and what are the preventatives. That's what Sugar Bear spoke about on Friday's segment when he spoke about he got involved with learning about the disease as his doctor was giving him the diagnosis. And that's why he was able to know, wait a minute, like you just said, you know now how to watch your diet. You now understand that you can still play and be a cheerleader and do all these things. These are things that people tend to lose focus on when they're diagnosed. Now, another thing that comes from anger when it comes down to medical, a lot of people do blame the people that is part of the genetic makeup. Like, why did my ancestors have to have that and now I'm stuck with it? There's been a whole bunch of points of anger, and some people grieve themselves before they've even been told that they have only a little bit of time to live or something. Some people actually grieve before they were even given what the prognosis of the diagnosis is. And that's what's funny. It's like they'll sit there and say, all they heard is, you know, that happened with me twice. I have rheumatoid arthritis in my family. Okay, mm-hmm. I had a car accident in 2005, and you remember, because that was where I was laid up for that year. Okay, yeah. Well, as they were giving me all of the scans and the CAT scans and the MRIs and the X-rays, they told me that the first vertebrae of my spine, right beneath my skull, that the spinal cord is sort of inside the spinal column, and like my head is literally wobbling around. Okay, so at first they thought it was from the accident, okay, until they looked a little further and realized that it was something going on with my bones where it's not, had nothing to do with impact, it has to do with congeniality.
Mm-hmm.
It's congenital. And now I was like remembering my aunt that just passed away, who she had arthritis as a child in her day where there were no treatments for it, so she was crippled up and bent over, and you know, and I just cried. I cried. I was like, I'm 27 years old, and I'm going to be crippled and, you know, caught up. So I started staying away from everybody. I didn't want nobody to tell me I was pretty. I didn't want to look. I didn't want anybody to see it because I felt like in just a few months, I'm going to be like this. And it's been 6 years since that happened.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm standing straighter than ever, but I started to learn things. I had to, after the anger, after the sadness, after me grieving my own funeral, I started looking into it and talking with specialists about what exactly that meant. Okay, just like I have left bundle branch block. That's where your left side of your heart doesn't pump energy or electricity to your heart like it's supposed to. And I was having sort of like occasional and random stroke-like symptoms at some point, you know, and I didn't understand it. Numbness sometimes. When I got there, I have not one block artery because I don't eat fried foods like that. I don't really cook with oil. I use the Pam sprays. I take, you know, anything fried in at a very, very, very minimal because I know how to make everything taste really good without the danger of the bad cooking or whatever. And thank you, gentlemen, for listening in because I see that you're sitting there nice and patient. But I was mad at the world. Like, you know, what's the matter? My heart, you know, one side of my heart literally does not pump electricity properly. And I'm still here. And I've been living with this for I don't know how long. But we just found out about it because I had the symptoms with my arm going numb at one point. At one time, I really had like a constricting chest pain, right? I was in a club with my girlfriends for my birthday. And I was walking. I don't even drink. But I was walking, and all of a sudden, my eyes just blew back. And so about 2 to 3 minutes, I couldn't breathe or anything, and then it just went away. And so I was told that I could have been living with this for quite some time because there's no way to tell exactly when it happened. But then on top of all of that, it started to become prominent after certain birth control that I was using. And since I was smoking cigarettes, certain birth control, while it's not like invasive to your body, like automatically have a bad impact, the smoking can actually make side effects happen. So I wasn't sure was it something that's been happening or it was there and this made it worse. So we can't tell that. All I know is that I'm living with it. And right now at any point in time, it could go at any time or maybe not. But I'm living and I'm learning all about it. And there wasn't a high mortality rate on it or anything. So one of the things that we could do, that you can do when you're still angry with what you're going through, is look at the fact that you're still here and that you're able to walk, and look at worst-case scenarios of people that are suffering with your disease. Learn about it. Learn what changed from the time that it used to be around to what you're at now. And then ask yourself, if, let's say the doctor did give you 6 months to live, do you want to spend your 6 months being pissed off with the world, being mad at something you cannot change from happening? But you can afford yourself more time to live, because you can live healthy, you can live better, you might even go past what the doctor said. The doctor's only a man. God has the final say. For those of you that lost loved ones to another person's crime, forgiveness is definitely something that you must do for you. It's not giving that person a free pass to have taken your loved one's life, but you have to start breathing. I mean, Monday, I realized that something was going on with me about my daughter's situation that I never knew existed, but I knew something used to nag me. When I just realized, I had blamed myself for not saying no to going to the movies, and I felt like I had a big hand in sending her out there. And for the longest, I didn't realize that existed. She had to tell me. She made it come out in one simple question. And then she said to me, you have to forgive yourself. I didn't realize that I was not forgiving myself or that I was blaming myself. So many of these things can restrict you, literally. They can physically make you not breathe. They can stop you from living life. Deacon Williams had to step off because he wasn't feeling too good. He'll be back. But he's walking around beating the odds with the spinal column surgery where he wasn't supposed to be able to walk at all. So we're still living, and we're still able to tell somebody. And through our hurt, somebody's looking at us and wondering how we could have still be where we are. How are we still where we are after all that we've gone through, when they're looking at you and saying, if I went through what you went through, I'd be crazy by now. So in a way, like you, Elaine, you are actively involved with Little League sports. You walk around telling people what you have and how you deal with it. You are the epitome of beauty and sweetness and strength, and nobody sits there and understands that you take shots or you have an insulin therapy or that you have to watch. You're a pastry chef, and you can barely taste your own things. Am I right?
Yeah, that's right. That's why I have my daughter. Right now, just think about just saying, taking on things. I'm like, right now, I just finished making a pumpkin cake, which I'm being paid for to do this, and I can't even taste this. So I give it to him. I'm like, oh, Athena, do me a favor. She'll taste it for me, or my mother will taste it. I'm like, okay, how does it taste? And she tell me, okay, it tastes like this, this, that, and needs more this, and needs more that. So it's like I need their tongue over my tongue to taste what I made.
You know what? Carla, when I come back, I'm going to go to our last break. When I come back, I want to ask you, again, from your professional standpoint, how all of these things, are working, some final suggestions from you. And, Rod, I want to hear from you once more. Deacon Williams, feel better. I will be back. To all of you survivors, to all of you that are out there going through this, here's another song I'm dedicating to you and myself and to my brave daughter, Mel. Oh, mommy loves you. I'm very proud of you for everything. And for giving your mother strength without even knowing it. This is Gloria Estefan. We're coming out of the dark. And for those of you who don't know where this came from, she suffered a car accident. She was a victim of a car accident that took her out of commission for a long time. And she came back when they told her she couldn't. This is her story. So coming out of the dark is to all of you from me. Be back in 4 minutes.
Why be afraid if I'm not alone? Life is never easy, rest is unknown. And up to now for me it's been hands against souls. And each and every moment searching what to believe.
Come in.
See the light now. starting again is part of the plan. And I'll be so much stronger holding your hand. Step by step, I'll make it through. I know I can. May not make it easier, but I have felt you feel the way.
Coming out of the dark,
finally see light now, and it's shining on me.
I see the light, I see the light,
see the light,
see the light. Coming out of the dark,
no one comes to save me, sharing with me.
Now, back with more On The Edge.
Welcome back, everybody, to the On The Edge show with Katie Barnett and friends. I am here with a panelist full of wonderful, wonderful people with great insight. We are speaking on part two of victimization. Rest in peace. Monday night, I keep saying yesterday, but Monday night we spoke on the angle of direct victims of crime, where, you know, you've been raped or mugged or robbed in your own house, or, you know, shot and you're living with a handicap from it or whatever the case is. But today we're speaking on being a victim to grief and trauma. Grief from finding out that you have a disease or an illness that's going to affect your life or could take your life, or losing a loved one to a crime or a sudden factor. Okay? And I've unmuted all of you. You're all back live on the panel. So Carl is our therapist on the panel today, and I'm going to ask him to give his final. Well, before I do, Carl, I want you to tell them, aside from the therapist angle, what else it is that you do, because we will be having you here on Friday as our guest to speak on this other crusade mission that you're on. So please explain that to our guests.
Okay. Oh, thank you. Briefly, I put together a DVD back in August titled What About Us and What the Verdict Meant for Us. It was about the George Zimmerman verdict of the Trayvon Martin murder. And one of the things that I do is I like to go out there and I like to talk about the world as we see it from an Afrocentric point of view. I make no apologies about my views and about who I am. I am an African who was born in America, and I like to look at things from that lens. So one of the things that I wanted to talk about, well, several of the things that we're going to talk about on Friday is we're going to talk about the precedent that was set during the George Zimmerman trial. And we're going to talk about what that actually means to the black community abroad. We're going to talk about the the careless acts of violence that have been perpetrated towards young African-American men since then. The message of white supremacy and the reintroduction of Jim Crow that was allowed in the case. The fact that the case in itself was pretty much a mock trial, how I pointed this out in August, and now there have been revelations since then to verify that account. Talk about that. We're going to talk about how it wasn't necessarily George Zimmerman on trial, but that you had black males, black females, black youth being tried in the eyes of public opinion, okay, in the court of public opinion, between Trayvon Martin and you had Rachel Dentell, and how their images were used to try to paint a picture of our youth as these big, as these demons, or how to demonize us, actually, as a people. And we're also going to talk about the Boulé caste system, how people in the black community are used as a buffer zone for the system of white supremacy. So we're going to get into all that and more. But those are some of the things that are available, and some of the issues that I've touched on the DVD, What About Us, What the Verdict Meant for Us, and we're going to get into that more so on Friday.
Okay. Well, now I would like for you to tell me. You heard what I felt, and what Sugar Bear, the comedian who's dealing with prostate cancer, spoke on. What's mm-hmm. your take? Professional standpoint, do you think that one of the ways a person who has found out that they have been medically afflicted with something, do you think that that person has more of a shot at breaking the cycle of remaining a victim to their own anger if they got more involved with being educated with what they're afflicted with, learning how they can do their own point of fighting?
Well, here's what I believe. I believe that in situations like that, we all have the fight or flee mentality. You know, that kicks in. You know, it's part of our mind, and we all have that where either we can run from our diagnosis, run from our situation, and pretty much run from who we are, or we can fight. And what I mean by fight is we can become educated. We can take charge in that situation. And I think that you are all taking charge in your situation. You decided that your ailment is not going to define who you are. You're going to become educated. You're going to become outspoken. You're going to become advocate for the people who are going to stand up and face these challenges and move forward. So I definitely believe being educated is part of taking on that challenge. Understanding how it happened to you, and understanding what can you do from this point forward. I think that's a very important thing. A lot of times, you know, we catch hell, and we're trying to figure out, you know, a lot of times we get to the point where we're saying, why me, why me? And sometimes we have to move past it to the point where, okay, why did it happen, and what can I do to get to wrecking this ship? And just for instance, you guys brought up a point where if someone gave you 6 months to live, how would you spend that 6 months? And I was personally sitting there saying, I would write my bucket list, and I would be on the plane, I'd be out the door, I'd be, you know, doing all sorts of things because, you know, I can't let the ailment define me. I have to go out there and finish defining the chapters of my life, be it 6 months from now, 6 years from now, and who knows? Because, as you said before, doctors, first of all, we have to get out of the notion that doctors are God, that they give you, you know, that they can tell you the time or the place of your demise. You know, a lot of times, you know, I had a grandfather, he had prostate cancer. His doctor gave him 6 months to live. 10 years later, he was still sipping corn liquor. unfortunately, my mother passed away 4 years ago, but 10 years ago, her doctor gave her a 50% chance of living 6 months to a year with sarcoidosis. It's the same disease that took Bernie Mac and Reggie White from us. We took matters into our own hands, and we went out and pursued that different medical opinion. But the bottom line is, we were not going to let that diagnosis define her final chapter or our final chapter. We were going to be the ones take the pen out of fate's hand and write our own ending. So, you know, we have to be the ones to take charge of our own destinies. Understand that there are going to be ups and downs. We're going to have some good days. We're going to have some bad days. But in our time to heal, that when, you know, we're going to have to understand that when we have those bad days, that, you know, we need our support system to kick in, be it spiritually, be it relationships, if we have a place of rest that we go to get our battery recharged. We have to have that one thing that we hold on to, that we can go to when we're having those down days, so that we can have our spirits lifted and realize that tomorrow can be a better day. So those are some of the things that those are some of the suggestions that I make. And like I said before, each individual situation is different. So what might work for client A may not necessarily work for client B, C, or D. But
that's true.
If you keep in mind that, you know, these things are going to happen, there's always something in the deck that we can pull out that should, you know, move us forward in terms of us dealing with these situations.
Thank you very much, Rod.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I'm still here.
Thank you very much for listening. And your final advice or suggestions?
Just more or less, just leave room for the fact that there's always going to be a little bit of bad in your life, but it won't always overwhelm you. And as the other guy mentioned, in larger support group with, you know, people who have happy as well as bad in their life, hopefully more good, you know, more beer, fun stuff like that. everyone's, you know, always going to be happy. It's okay to be sad sometimes, but, I mean, you can say, okay, I'm going to be sad for 2 hours a day. And after those 2 hours, you know, tap on your support group. What are you doing? And they may be, you know, again, feeling that anchor on them. And all together, you can cut that anchor at once. It's like, you know what? We're going to the bakery today. I know we're not supposed to, but we can have that one slice. You know, yeah. we can have a little fun. You know, enjoy ourselves right. Once. After all, there is a God. However, there's God, there's a devil. But there's going to be more God, more good than evil. And if we finish the rest of our life with this, I mean, we can get rid of that anchor. You know, all those nasty memories, they won't define us. We'll have more good memories. Things like, you know what? He said, next time I think I can have a bigger slice. I talked to my doctor, and he said, I'm a lot stronger than I was. So that's a good thing going forward, more cake.
Okay, that's absolutely true. But listeners, he mentioned beers. We do not advocate people to go out and buy beers or drink more alcohol of any kind. Okay, just kidding. Deacon, you definitely have been qualified to offer, you know, your inside advice on it.
Well, I know what works for me is to just turn it over to the Creator, because I know through Him I'm going to be all right, and everything else is going to be all right, because there's still some things in me that needs to be worked on. And I know with the support and the love that I have from people around me, that it's going to be all right. It's going to be all right.
Well, thank you very much. And you're always a positive person. Even when we speak about the show topics and things to that effect, you are very positive throughout everything that you're going through. So I draw from that, especially being spiritual myself, and I appreciate that you're consistently doing that. because there's so much more negative than there is positive out there. Negative is a dime a dozen. It seems like the rare gem is to be positive in it.
Yeah. Well, see, and I just want to commend you because it takes a lot of courage and strength for you to get on this air and you know, share your stories out here. But you have to know that you're touching and you're helping somebody out there somewhere.
Thank you for that. You guys, all of you were very super, the support that you guys loaned on the air and off the air, it was amazing to me, and I wanted to thank you. And I was actually showing my daughter the comments and telling her about, you know, how all of you, wrote in. And she was already proud because she's like, Mom, I told you I'm already advocating. I'm pastors. But to see it, it just reaffirmed with her that she's doing a good thing, you know, and that she can once again slowly detach herself from what that ditch were or what it made her. Elaine, I want to hear from you. How are you dealing? What is your last remarks to somebody? You're dealing with something every day.
Well, I feel that anything that has happened in the past or present that has changed anybody's life, no matter how bad it is, you have to know how to try to find a way to research it, to find a networking of friends to help us through it, to find a piece of ourselves. I remember hearing your story on Monday, and it brought me to tears. Even though I heard it before, I remember hearing just the story on Monday. Anyway, lay down next to my daughter and hold her tighter. You know,
right.
The stuff that I've gone through in the past with my health issues and everything, it's stuff that I had to research and look it up myself. You know, even though I got older, there was no internet back then, but there's internet now, and it's like, you have to give people a clear knowledge of what's going on health-wise, any disease that's out there. I mean, like my diabetes itself, like I said, not that many people understand that diabetes is not only, oh, this person is so fat because they eat too much sugar. This person has diabetes, eat a lot of sugar. No, people forget that it's an imbalance inside the body. It's the pancreas. The pancreas produces insulin, and people forget that. Once that pancreas goes, that's when the diabetes starts kicking in. Because the amount of sugar that you eat, any food you eat turns into sugar. So, of course, your body's going to be rejecting and giving out a lot of, it's not going to give you any insulin to cover the sugar that's going into your body. Nobody understands that. They think it's the opposite.
Ladies, I'm going to have to ask you to repeat that whole little bit because you got very muffled and staticky toward the end.
Sorry.
So start from where.
I'm walking around. I'm near my oven, keeping out of my cake. You know.
This is a pumpkin cake. No, I want the really big one, the big cupcake that's with a big candle in.
Oh, okay, I know what you're like. I have the mold up here. I have that mold. You can do that.
Okay. I want to thank all of you. We are down to our last 6 minutes.
We can do that too. More cake.
Forget me first, okay? I'm the host here. I'm the first one. I'm a
first
board. Last 3 minutes. Let me thank all of you for your outstanding support, for your outstanding input tonight. Rod and now Carl and definitely Lady Di and Zeke, for your consistency and your continuation here. I appreciate it very much. But I do want to say, and I want to try to squeeze this in our last little minutes, there is a little group of things you can start to do with Breaking the Cycle. We applied this to Monday segment, and it applies to this as well. You have to deal with your illness. You got to deal with healing from it or going through what it takes to heal. you have to acknowledge that there are going to be changes in you. That is the one thing that a lot of people don't like to do. They don't want to accept that there may be a physical handicap or a restriction from what they've been diagnosed with. You have to. The same applies for you having lost a loved one. Okay? You are going to be physically restricted and mentally restricted until the grief passes you. So you have to do that. You have to allow yourself to do that guilt-free for a while. Okay? Don't kick off support and counseling, but that can be counseling to be later. Acknowledge that if you were a victim, acknowledge that your child was a victim or your loved one was a victim, and that the other person violated, and think about what your loved one would have wanted. Okay? Advocate. Because that's constructive for you. Advocate somehow. You don't have to talk in front of a bunch of people, but you could be there to help somebody get that ear that's just sitting there without talking that you need it. Okay? Do not alienate, but direct people and delegate what type of help that they can do to have that actually helps you. You know, you don't want them to go beat up the person that shot you or raped you or the doctor for telling you you had the disease. You want them to be there for you. Okay, we can do this. Start kicking victimization in the face 1 minute at a time. Not one step, not one day. 1 second to 1 minute at a time. All right, there's hold on a minute. All right, there is not, you don't have steps so much as you have seconds and minutes when it comes to being a victim. It's 1 second at a time. If you can make it from 1 second to the next, you survive. You've overcome. Okay? So with that being said, look for us to continue. Part three tomorrow night is the conclusion. This is going to be speaking more, even though all of this will be readdressed, we are going to be helping those of you that are loved ones of victims that are suffering. Okay? Because you guys are standing on the sidelines trying to help and trying to do something and you don't know what to do. So before you give up walking, come see this show, come listen to it, and let's talk about it because I've been on both ends.
Hello?
Did we get clicked off?
Yeah, they're working on that pumpkin now.
Yeah.
It ain't right.
Yeah, whatever happened to shit.
It ain't right.
I can still hear the show, but I think we're off the air. Well, brothers, it was
one of you that starts laughing, because I know that was you all starting this, right? Every night around this time, when we've gone past our credits, they let me know by cutting me off.